for a long spell. We've not had PowerPoint presentations, but I'm on fire here for that, so we're having another PowerPoint presentation, which I thought would facilitate what we're going to talk about today. So on November 28th, something began. Just raise your hands. How many of you know what began on November 28th? Okay, so it's called Hanukkah. That's the most the name we're familiar with. Hanukkah is the what this date it began on that date, and there's a reason. And so we'll and as you see the two candelabras there, and you'll see that there, if you really start counting the candles, you'll find out that the one on the left is the Hanukkah candle, and it has nine of the candles, and on the right is the menorah that was found in the temple, and it has seven. So how many of you know why there are nine on one and not seven? So my wife knows, because she was telling me what the middle one means, and I think it's the Squamish. Yeah, and anyway, it's the helper candle, because they take that middle one and use it to light all the others. So anyway, it's the helper candle. That little tidbit of information, so when you're talking to other people about Hanukkah, you can tune them in, and they'll be impressed with your knowledge. So anyway, the next thing that we have, by what other names is Hanukkah known? So, first thing is Feast of Lights. The second thing is the Feast of Dedication. So it's known by as Hanukkah. It's known as the Feast of Lights. It's known as the Feast of Dedication. Now, is Hanukkah mentioned in the Bible? Is Hanukkah mentioned in the Bible? It's mentioned most directly in the New Testament, but something that takes place in the Old ties in with this, and it's a prophetic element, which we will talk about, that's found in the book of Daniel. So the Feast of Dedication is mentioned in John chapter 10, verse 22. And it says, "Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch." So Jesus went up to the feast, and Jesus was there when they had the Feast of Dedication. And as you look at the Feast of Dedication, it's not a holy day. It is a Jewish national observance, and it's not a holy day. It's just a day that's important to the Jews. For instance, for us, the days that are important to us in our history, you have the Declaration of Independence, and so July the 4th, Independence Day, and then you have the Thanksgiving. Those are two national days that we observe, and they're not biblical. They're just national days, and the same thing is true for the Feast of Lights, or the Feast of Dedication. Now, why would we, you know, as you look at this, why would we talk about this on the Sabbath day? It's just a Jewish national holiday. Why would we talk about it today on God's Sabbath? Well, there's a pretty dramatic story about the Feast of Dedication that not only shows God's faithfulness, but it also shows the reliability of prophecy, because something prophetic relates to this, which we'll talk about as we go through the sermon today. So it has elements, you know, you see Christ observing it, and you see it's a national holiday. Then we come to the temple. Now, this is in one sense the third temple, because the first temple was Solomon's temple that was built. The second temple, you could look at it as the temple that was built after the Jews returned from Babylon. And then the third temple is really a continuation of the second, because what they did is completely revamp the temple area. in a fabulous way, to where the Temple of Herod, and it was built by Herod, and it was a fabulous building. And I was just reading about it yesterday, and if you look at the construction, it was truly amazing. Some of the stones that are in this, huge blocks of stone, and if you looked at the corner of the temple, and you're up on top, and you go down to the Kidron Valley, which is the east, if you look on the right-hand side, that's the Kidron Valley. And that corner is 8 stories. It is 8 stories down to the Kidron Valley. So it was a fabulous, fabulous building. And I don't have the picture, but in going through and looking at Herod's temple, basically it's not a flat surface. So what they did is they went in and made it a flat surface. So it's truly an astounding project. And underneath Herod's temple, there were all, it wasn't, they made it flat, but there are all these different gaps in there that remained. And so it's quite an interesting building. So Christ is there at the temple, and the temple of Herod was the one that was operational in Christ's time. And it talks about when it's mentioned in John, it talks about Solomon's court, and where was that? Well, if you go back here, just so you know, this is Solomon's court right here. Okay, and this, all these columns along here, this was, and this is the, you know, I heard different explanations, so I'm just telling you, in one sense, you kind of get, it's right here, but, you know, it talks about all these, this colonnade area all around the temple court. And so anyway, it's, you get different people defining it different ways. And in this photo on the left, it defines it, this is Solomon's court or portico, and then this is kind of an artist's representation of what that looked like. You see the temple out here, and then you have people gathered underneath it. So it's it was truly a fabulous building, and Christ was in Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication, and so you have this is something that's part of Jewish history, and so we're going to talk about how this originated. So as you look at the history, it involves the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. So when Judah fell to the Babylonians in 586 BC, the Babylonians came in, and the Jews had basically made the Babylonians pretty angry, so they came in, and you're going to pay. You know, you guys have stirred up trouble, you've rebelled against us, so we're going to take care of the problem once and for all. So they conquered the city of Jerusalem in 586 BC, and they not only conquered the city, but they destroyed the temple. And so and this is before Herod's temple. So this is the destruction of Solomon's temple. And to destroy it and to get rid of the stones and all of that, that took some work. And, you know, but they did, because they said, we're getting rid of these guys. And they took the people of Judah into captivity. So many of them had been taken in other conquests, the original conquest. And in 586 was the final conquest, and they took people back to Babylon. And basically the land, the Jews, there were some Jews that remained behind. They couldn't get them all, but they took many of them to Babylon, and the people of Judah began to live in Babylon. And Jeremiah told them, just this is the way it is, and it's going to be this way for 70 years, so make the most of it. Build your houses, plant your gardens, go on having families and all of those kind of things, because for 70 years you're going to be living in captivity in Babylon. And so that's what they did. But another thing that comes into this is Daniel's prophecies. So Daniel predicted the rise and fall of four great kingdoms. So he predicted that in making these predictions, the first thing that Nebuchadnezzar saw and Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar about was this great image on the plain of Shinar. And so you had a head of gold, and you had various other elements, and each of the elements of this great statue represented different kingdoms that would rise. So Babylon was the head of gold and is also later in Daniel symbolized by a lion. You have the Medo-Persian Empire, which was the chest and arms of silver and represented by a bear. And then you had the Greco-Macedonian Empire of Alexander and the belly and thighs of bronze and a leopard. And then you had the Roman Empire with legs of iron and feet of iron mixed with clay. And the beast that it was representing it was a very unusual, vicious beast, which basically stomped everything into oblivion. That was the Roman approach. So that empire rose. So anyway, when Daniel's making these prophecies, one of the things that he foresaw was that the kingdom of Babylon would fall. And so he could see, God helped him be able to see that this would take place. And, you know, Daniel goes on to talk about this big party they're having there in Babylon. And basically what happens is they're having this party, and all of a sudden there's this handwriting on the wall, and it says, "Many, many, Tekel, Upharsin," and basically says, Babylon's going to fall this very night. So they have the party. This writing is on the wall. It says you've been weighed and tried in the balance, so Babylon is going to fall. So they're having this big party, even as the Medes and Persians are coming into the city. So they felt that their city was so well built and well protected, they didn't have anything to worry about. However, they didn't stop to think about the fact that the river flowed through the city. And if you stop the river, which is exactly what Cyrus the Great did, they diverted the river, and the river stopped flowing, so his troops could go underneath the gates and enter the city. So it fell that night, and Daniel was able to understand what this was all about, but he never got any of the reward because the king who made those promises died in the conflagration that took place. So the Medes and Persians took the city of Babylon and conquered that empire, and the empire of the Medes and Persians superseded that kingdom. And a new kingdom began. And it was ruled, to begin with, by Cyrus the Great. Eventually we'll see him. There he is. So anyway, he conquered Babylon. And when he conquered Babylon, then you begin to see the history that's going to lead to the Feast of Dedication unfold. And this begins to unfold in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. So the people of Judah are in Babylon. They have been in captivity, but things change once the Medes and Persians conquer Babylon. So it says, now in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1, it says, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. So it's been 70 years since Jeremiah gave his prophecy. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me. And he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. And so we tend to see this in Ezra and conclude, well, this is just referring to Judah, which it was, but he did this to other kingdoms that had been conquered as well and was going to offer them the same opportunity. So it says, they're going to build a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel, that he is God, which is in Jerusalem, and whoever is left in any place where he dwells, let the men of his place help him with silver and gold, with gold and livestock, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. So Cyrus decreed that the Jews could return to the land of promise. And you think, well, they're all going to pack up and go back home, and that's not true. A portion of them did, but you realize that they've been there 70 years, and this was home for them. Babylon was home for them, and they had houses, they had businesses, they had family there, and only a portion of the Jews who had been transported to Babylon went back to the land of promise. Only a portion of them did. So Cyrus made this decree, and he opened the way for them to be able to return to the land of promise. Now, so the first wave of people returning to Judea was under Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel was a descendant of the royal house, and he led a portion of the Jews back to the land. So the first thing, and you know, as they came back, everything is a shambles. There's no temple, there are no walls, and you have people that are opposing this. Even though Cyrus has decreed this, a lot of people aren't on board with it, especially the people who've occupied the land. So they basically were in opposition to this. So Zerubbabel leads the first group back. Later on, you have others who come back under Ezra and under Nehemiah. And they played a big role in rebuilding the city. They eventually rebuilt the temple. And as they rebuilt the temple, and the scriptures speak about that, as they rebuilt the temple, it wasn't anywhere near what Solomon's temple had been like. Solomon's temple was a truly magnificent building, one of the seven wonders of the world. And when they built the new temple to replace the old, it was pretty sad. You know, it just, and the people saw it. Those people who remembered back to when Solomon's temple were there said, yeah, this is the temple, but it was disappointing. But they were happy to have a place of worship once again, nonetheless. So Nehemiah played a role in that, and then you had Nehemiah played more of a role in building the walls, because things really did not move forward until they had the walls, which provided them protection. And Nehemiah returned to the land, and Nehemiah undersaw the building of the walls and got the people rallied so that they could get that done. So you see the temple, and it was the temple, and it was set up based on the same pattern, which is the Garden of Eden. You know, as you look at the Garden of Eden, you had a holy place, and then you had eventually where the Holy of Holies is, where God dwelt. And that was the Garden of Eden. Well, and you had outside of those two locations, you had an altar. And so they set all that up, and as you see here in front is an altar, and then you had the holy place, and then at the very back of the temple, you had the Holy of Holies. So it was built in the same way. And as they built it and they put everything in place, the curtain and all of that, you no longer had the Ark of the Covenant. That was gone. And, you know, you have movies that play on that, and they're exciting, but we don't know where the Ark of the Covenant is. Does it still exist? Who knows? Someday we'll find out. But anyway, and God never dwelled in the temple again. Never did dwell in the temple. So this temple was completed in the 400s BC, and God never dwelled there. So when God left before the fall of Jerusalem and the city, God left, and Ezekiel chronicles that, and he talks about God leaving and exiting the temple, going out to the Mount of Olives, where he ascends to heaven. So God never dwelled with them again, not in the way that he had in the past. Now, did God ever come back to the temple? He most assuredly did. When he came in the flesh, he came back, and one of the main places where he did his work was in the temple. It wasn't the only place, but he did his work in the temple, and it was in the place where they made sacrifice of the red heifer out east of the temple that Christ was crucified. So that's my opinion, and we believe that he was sacrificed to the east and up on the Mount of Olives and died there. And where did he ascend from when he returned to heaven? The Mount of Olives. And where is he going to return to when he comes back the second time? Amazingly, he's going to return to the Mount of Olives. So anyway, as you look at the building of this temple, it was all completed around 516, 515 BC, and it is the time when the temple was completed. So as you look at what takes place with Herod's temple, it was a much more spectacular temple. So into the story comes an individual that we know as Alexander the Great. So Alexander the Great he became, for some reason, dedicated to conquering the world. That's not a normal dream of young boys, but he dreamed about conquering the world. So that was his plan, and so he got his forces together, and they began a conquest of the world. And as you look at Alexander the Great, Alexander the Great was ruthless. Okay, if you're going to conquer the world, you probably have to be ruthless, and he was. So when they crossed into Asia Minor and they began their journey across Asia Minor, basically when the Greeks engaged in battle with other people, and if they broke through, basically once that took place, people surrendered and they didn't kill too many people. But that wasn't Alexander the Great's approach. If they broke the opposing army, then they all chased down the enemy and killed as many of them as they possibly could. So it was a new approach to war, just total warfare, kill everybody, and that way you eliminate people that are going to oppose you. So Alexander the Great was an effective general, and so basically he conquered the world in a very short period of time. If you look at Daniel 11, verses 3 through 4, it speaks of Alexander the Great. Daniel 11, verses 3 through 4. It says, and speaking of the rise of Alexander the Great, and the language in verse 4 clearly suggests that this mighty conqueror was going to have a comparatively brief reign. In 7 or 8 years, he accomplished the most dazzling military conquest in human history, but he lived only four more years and died of a fever in 323 BC. And so Alexander the Great comes into the story, and he and his generals play a part in what unfolds and leads to the Feast of Dedication. So fundamentally, Alexander, as he began to do his work, Alexander believed that the highest culture in the world at that time was Greek culture. It was the highest culture. In fact, as you look at the Greeks, anybody that didn't speak Greek, they called them barbarians. Because to their ears, when other people spoke, they spoke barbar. You know, something you can't understand, gibberish. And they called them barbarians. And that was the Greek approach. Everybody was inferior to the Greeks. And he felt that our culture, our literature, and everything about Greek society is the pinnacle. And Alexander so firmly believed in Greek culture that he wanted to proselytize the world. In essence, preach the gospel of the Greeks to the entire world. And that was his approach as he led his army eastward. And they sought to establish Greek ideas and Greek education and Greek philosophy throughout the world because they believed it was the best. So he sought to proselytize those he conquered to accept Hellenic or Greek culture, which is called Hellenization. You become Greek, and you look at our society. Have we been Hellenized? Oh yeah, we have, because many of the ideas of our educational system trace back to the Greeks and the Romans. So all this ancient culture still impacts us to this day. Also, the heirs of Alexander the Great, they felt the same way. Greek culture is the best, and we want to spread Greek culture everywhere we go. And the process of spreading Greek language and culture, as I said, is called Hellenization, and Hellenization is one of the main reasons the New Testament was written in Greek. And one of the benefits to that is that as the apostles began to go out and preach the gospel, they could speak Greek, they could write Greek. And the world in which they went into, Greek was understood very widely. So then people could understand them, they could speak to them in Greek, they could write in Greek and people would understand. And God was aware of that. So as you look at history unfolding and Greek spreading, it allowed for the gospel to be preached. And one of the things that you also get from the dispersion of the Jews, they were conquered, brought back to Babylon, and they didn't stay there. They moved on to other places, north, south, east, and west. And what did they establish? They established synagogues. And as a result of that, as the apostles went out and began to preach the gospel, you had places where they could begin their work. So they would go into a city. If it had a synagogue, they were able to speak to them until they offended them and got kicked out. But they would be able to start there. Because not everybody thought, I don't think this is such a good idea. And in fact, you're opposing our Jewish ideas, so maybe you need to stop it. You can't come into the synagogue anymore. So then you're going to have to find a different way to approach the people there. So anyway, Alexander died in 323 BC. And so he died and his empire was divided into four smaller parts. Smaller and weaker empires, and Alexander did not have anybody in his family that could take over. So it came down to, after infighting, four generals who basically asserted themselves and took over the empire. So the empire was vast, running all the way from Greece all the way to the Indus River. So it was a vast empire. Very, very large and ruled by the descendants of Alexander and his generals. And so the two that are most important for us are the descendants of Seleucus, who took over Syria, which is this part of the empire, and a fellow by the name of Ptolemy, who took over Egypt. And all of these other areas are still being ruled, but the main focus is on these two empires because they're going to play a part in what unfolds and helps to bring about what we know as the Feast of Dedication. So time goes on and the empires are fighting as empires do. So we come down to the time when, you know, you can see here that the Romans have taken over Greece and they've taken over part of the Asia Minor, but you still have the descendants of Seleucus ruling here to the east, and you have Ptolemy's descendants still ruling here. So the configurations of the empires have changed quite a bit. And then into the story comes a fellow by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. So his name was Antiochus, and And Epiphanes means illustrious. So most of us probably wouldn't put that particular wording next to our names, Gary Illustrious Smith. I don't think we would do that, but living in that time, people did. And it's amazing, you know, these people represented themselves as God, and it's just the world that was at that time. So Antiochus Epiphanes comes into the picture, and Daniel spoke about him in the verses Daniel 11, 21 through 35, and we'll just summarize these verses. And these verses speak of Antiochus the Fourth, known as Epiphanes, the brother of Seleucus IV, who had earlier been taken hostage to Rome. So Antiochus Epiphanes was taken to Rome, and he lived there for a while as he was young, and he was very impressed with the Romans and had a good relationship with them. And so he eventually assumed the throne, and he's seen by different writers as a tyrannical oppressor who did his utmost to destroy the Jewish religion altogether. So he firmly believed that Greek was best, and he came to enforce that, to push that. If you will not accept Greek ideas and ways, then there will be a price to pay. You might think about this in light of where we're at this time in the world. So Antiochus Epiphanes was going to push Greek ideas, and he definitely looked at the Jews, and there were Jews who would compromise, but there are other Jews that said, sorry, we can't do that. What you're asking us to do, we can't do. So Antiochus was involved in warfare between his empire and Egypt. And, you know, the two empires, Egypt and Syria, basically fought each other like cats and dogs, each trying to gain advantage and expand their empire. And Antiochus continued this approach. And so Antiochus is going to be invading Egypt, and so he needs to shore up Judea, because that's the back of his, where he's leaving from Judea and invading Egypt. So he wants to make sure that everything is solid behind him. So he's in order that he can attack Egypt. A part of his plan involved a Jew named Menelaus, who had bribed his way into office of the office of the high priest, and with the promise of giving Antiochus high tribute, and so he was basically in office because he bribed his way into it, and so he's going to give high tribute, and he also assured Antiochus that he would assist the king in Hellenizing the Jews. So I'll assist you, and I'll help all these people come around to your way of thinking, the Greek way of thinking. So he believed that he could do that and told Antiochus so. And though the Jewish leaders at first thought they could Hellenize their community while still retaining their unique form of worship. And that's an interesting thing that you have to think about. Can you compromise with the truth? And basically seem to conform to what's going on and say, well, I'll conform and I'll be fine. Can you do that? Well, you can't, but people say, well, the price is too high, so I'll outwardly seek to conform, but I really won't. And people have tried that, you know, in different situations, and that doesn't work out very well. So anyway, there were people that did compromise. Other people held fast to the truth. So there were a lot of people in the Jewish community did compromise. And so then but eventually the general populace didn't go along. This guy that had bribed his way into the priesthood, he didn't get the job done. So the people were resistant. They didn't go along as quickly as Antiochus wanted. So he was uncertain about them. So what did he do? He began to enforce what he wanted done. Now, this took place, Antiochus actually invaded Egypt. And the Egyptians realized they were not going to survive Antiochus's invasion. So what did they do? They called on the Romans. Hey, we need your help. So the Romans gave them help, and they were the big dog on the block, and basically they forced Antiochus to pull back. So he pulled back into the area of Judea, and he realized, hey, I've been defeated here, so he's angry, and these people aren't cooperating, so I'm going to take my anger out on them. And basically he came to the conclusion, you will go along with what I'm trying to accomplish or else. So he began to seek to stamp out the religion of God that was extant at this time in the 160s BC. And what took place there? You had the, go back. So basically the Sabbath day was outlawed, and other biblical feast days. The reading of the law of Moses was outlawed. All copies of the law of Moses were ordered to be burned. Temple sacrifices were forbidden. For instance, it says that during this time that an end was brought to the morning and evening sacrifice. That's in the book of Daniel. This actually is a historical reality. All circumcision was outlawed, which was a big deal to the Jews, and the penalty for disobedience was death. So basically, he decided, I'm going to stamp out all opposition. And he began to do that. And so a lot of people went along with that, and but other people didn't, and resistance kicked in. So when Antiochus Epiphanes pushed too far, he sought to set up a statue of Zeus in the temple. So he set that up there, and he also decided, well, we'll really show them, and we'll sacrifice pig's blood on the altar, which he did. And as you look at this picture on the right, you see that they're doing bad things to the people here. And you see the statue of Jupiter Olympus, this statue here, and they're making sacrifice. And so basically they're desecrating the altar, which the Jews were appalled by. And then you have an individual by the name of Judas Maccabee come on the scene. And this is recounted in 1 Maccabees. There were four different volumes written. The first one basically discusses a lot of these things. In Daniel speaks of this in Daniel, beginning in Daniel 11, verse 32. It says, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So Antiochus is pushing against the covenant and against the people, but those who are faithful are going to resist this. Verse 33, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So this is speaking of what took place in the 160s in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. But this is also something that's going to take place at the end of the age. It's going to take place at the end of the age and is something that is yet to come because Christ spoke about it in various places in the Gospels. So these verses appear to describe on one level the will of and courage of the Maccabees, a family of priests who resisted Antiochus and his successors. The Maccabees' revolt against the Syrian king was triggered while in the mountains 17 miles to the northwest of Jerusalem, and a popular revolt was beginning. In the town of Modin, the aged priest Mattathias had refused to offer the pagan sacrifice that was being required of him. I'm not going to do this. So basically, you will make this sacrifice or else. And he said, I'm not going to. And so he would not do it. But there was somebody there in that town that said, well, I'll take care of it. And Mattathias said, no, you're not going to do that. And he killed him. And then he killed the representative of Antiochus, and then the war was on. Mattathias was aided in his cause by five sons, most notably Judah, or Judas named Maccabah, and many of the patriots died in this cause, but their heroics ultimately drove the Syrian forces from the country. And really, this applies to the church as well at the end of the age. Because Antiochus Epiphanes is just a type of the beast to come at the end of the age. So the same mindset is going to predominate at the end of the age. So faithful Jews began resisting and rallying to this family of priests, and they soon began to wage a guerrilla war against their oppressors. Basically a David and Goliath battle with a small band of faithful loyalists taking on the military might of the Syrian army. And the Syrian army, they had 50,000 soldiers that invaded Judea. And if you were looking at 50,000 versus the ragtag group of people that rallied to Judah the Maccabee, you would think that there's going to be no contest. But they were bold, and they were dedicated to their cause, and ultimately, they defeated the Assyrians, or the Syrians. The Syrians said, okay, enough of this, and they pulled out. It's not worth it. So they pulled out, and this was important because you have to realize Antiochus was wanting to destroy God's religion at the time. So that's what the intent and purpose was. And what do you think that the next manifestation of this is going to be at the end of the age? It is going to be dedicated to destroying the true religion, to eliminating the people of God. You're going to be seen as resistant. And they're going to say, we have to get rid of these people. And they're going, and that's when the persecution is going to kick in. But you find that God was with the people in the 160s BC, and he will be with us as well. And it's going to end much better than this did. I mean, they defeated Antiochus, which was a miracle in itself. And so what did they seek to do? They sought to reestablish temple worship and to reestablish the morning and evening sacrifices, to establish everything that took place in the temple. And so when they began to rededicate themselves to God, they found they had hardly any oil. And the oil was crucial to lighting the menorah. So basically, we're going to run out pretty fast. But what happened is they lit the menorah as part of the rededication, and the oil lasted 8 days. So the candelabra was burning the entire 8 days, and that's why you have the eight places for the candles. And you have the eighth, which was used to light the other candles. So all of this took place and at the end of that war. And so God's people and God's religion continued on. Now, who do you think was behind all of this effort to destroy the true religion? None other than Satan, the devil. So we're going to wipe them out, eliminate them, and we're going to establish Greek thinking and Greek religion and all of those things. But that wasn't God's intent, and he didn't allow it to take place. He allowed the Jews to triumph. And the goal was to get to, you know, eliminate the true religion. But what happens if you do that? Where does Christ come to? Does he come back to the temple? That's not going to happen. Is he going to come back to his people? Well, God knew of Satan's intent, and he thwarted the effort of Antiochus Epiphanes. And as you go to the end of the age, it's going to be the same mindset. And you look at what they're trying to do, as you have the two witnesses at that time, they're going to be opposed, and they're going to fight against them. Not fight against them, but they're going to prophesy against these two evil individuals, and they're going to try to kill them. But you know what? They can't, because God's with them. Now, eventually, they do kill them, and the whole world rejoices. But the game's over by then. Yep, they're going to kill them. They're all going to rejoice, give gifts to each other, and they're going to be lying in the street until Christ returns. So they'll lie there until Christ returns, and then they will be resurrected, and they will meet Christ in the air. So let's look at what John 10, verses 22 through 28 says to say. It's now, it was the feast of dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter, and Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, "How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly." And Jesus had told them plainly and shown them beyond the shadow of a doubt that he was the Christ. And so then he goes on, "If you are the Christ, tell us plainly." And Jesus answered them, "I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. But you do not believe because you are not of my sheep. As I said to you, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish. Neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand." So, you know, we move day by day closer to the end of the age, and God says he's going to be with his people through to the end, to the time when Christ comes. And you look at what takes place here in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the rebellion of the Jews against the Antiochus, and it's a type of what's to come. As you look at what took place there, the Jews did triumph. But at the end of the age, the Christians are going to be attacked. But there's going to be no uprising. There are going to be people who don't go along with what's demanded. But those people aren't going to rise up in rebellion. But God will be with them. And just as Christ promises here, he will be with them to the end. And at the end of it, Christ returns and sets up his kingdom. So as you look at this, you sometimes think, well, this doesn't have much meaning at all. What is the Feast of Dedication? But that's because we don't fully understand what it's all about. And so, you know, you have Hanukkah going on, and it's something that we can all keep in mind. It's not something we have to observe, but it's something that is interesting, and there's a meaning and purpose to it. So hopefully that's been instructional for you, and there's a meaning and purpose that we can all take from it. And hopefully we can, as things unfold in the world, we can be ready for whatever comes our way, and we can hold fast to the truth. And, you know, as the days go by, you can see that, we may be challenged. And I don't look forward to it. You know, if you look at Germany as an example, if you refuse to comply with what the government is demanding, they're going to fine you $4,000, 4,000 euros, which is, I think it's $4,000, but so many euros, but that's a lot of money to pay. So anyway, these things are unfolding in our world, but thankfully they've not hit you and me at this particular point. So thanks for your attention.